So good morning. Today's workshop is on connecting and recovery, or most importantly, trust. Before I get to that, I'd like to get our clients to sign in. Could you give me your first name and last initial? Room number, if you could as well, please. If you have a visitor with you today, your visitor's first name and relationship to you. If you're just visiting the center, your alumni, just your first name and the fact that you're visiting. Connecting and recovery. Connecting and recovery really is about disconnecting in addiction and reconnecting in a healthy way. One of the things that tends to happen when people enter addiction is that not only do they start to get caught up in all kinds of processes as a result of the addiction, but people around them are often recruited into reorganizing, changing the ways they are. We find, for instance, communication is a great example. Communication in families where addiction is present really shrinks and changes, and it seems like the only thing we're talking about is Bob and his sobriety. Used to be once upon a time, mom would phone your sister, "How are you, honey? How's the wife? How's the husband? How's the kids? How's work?" Now it's, "Have you seen Bob? How did he look? It was payday. Did he look okay? Did he have any money?" All of a sudden, people stop talking. They stop connecting. They stop being together in the ways that they were together once upon a time. And instead, people just get caught up around the addiction. And what we tend to find is that at the end of the 35 days guys are here in treatment, people can head out, they can head home, they can step back into their lives, transformed, changed, healed. But they tend to walk back into the same damn stuff they left. It's as if, you know, I left 35 days ago and I walked back through the front door and it's like I was gone 35 minutes. I'm different, everything's different, but everything's the same. That process really speaks to how important it is to disconnect in addiction and reconnect in a healthy way. One of the things to appreciate is both the individual struggling to overcome addiction and the people who care about them need time and space to heal. When addiction enters somebody's life, it does not restrict its pain to the individual it ensnares. Addiction recruits people into being expert managers in the lives of people struggling with it. And it comes at the expense of managing or nurturing one's own life. One of the things that we really have to start with is this statement, this very strong statement, that the use of drugs and alcohol is and always is a choice. I can't say that enough. The use of drugs and alcohol is and always is a choice. My favorite definition of addiction, or one of my favorite definitions of addiction, is simply continuing to make the same damn bad choice over and over and over again, regardless of the consequences. In the face of the consequences. Really have to underscore the choice aspect of using, because there are an awful lot of people who care about our clients who take on responsibility for our guys ending up in addiction. If only I'd done something different. If only I'd loved them more. If only I'd been gentler. If only I'd been stricter. If only I'd been there more. If only I'd noticed. If only I'd kept him away from those bad influences. If only. Many of the people who care about our clients take on some form of responsibility for the using, for the addiction. It's really weird. By the time I meet guys here at the center, pretty much anyone who loves them is crystal clear on the fact that there's not a damn thing they can say or do to make Buddy stop. But they often have all kinds of beliefs about all kinds of things that they can do to make you start. Guys leave MRTC feeling strong, having faced all kinds of challenges. They arrive home at the end of 35 days ready to take on the world. And they find people walking on eggshells around them. "What's for dinner tonight?" "Brussels sprouts." "Brussels sprouts! He hates Brussels sprouts! Quick, throw them out, he might get loaded."
kids, put down the remote control. Daddy's trying to watch the Canucks. Sober. No, Billy. No, don't turn on Treehouse. Daddy might get loaded. All kinds of people will walk around on eggshells.
I worked with a guy, and his employer, his boss, cared enough to come in and do some work, attended some workshops. We did a couple of sessions together. His boss wanted to know, how can I help support him? It's great. 3 months after this guy left treatment, he worked a great program. I get this frantic email from his boss. He phoned in sick today. What do I do? I emailed him back, what do you do when anybody else phones in sick? Yeah, but what if he was using? What proportion of your employees do you think phone in sick because of a hangover the night before in any given year? Like, but once somebody has an addiction, don't want to give them any stress. Might make them use. Well, the use of drugs and alcohol is and always is a choice. It's one of the things that you have to, right from the start, appreciate. It is and always is a choice. You can't make somebody use. You can't trigger or cause somebody to use. Certainly there are things that you can do to make somebody's likelihood of using easier or more difficult. But you can't make them use. You know, stock their drug of choice in your home, and you're going to make their decision around not using that much more difficult. Empty it all out of the house, you're going to make their decision around not using that much simpler. Yeah.
When somebody's in active addiction, though, is it not common that really that your decision-making process is hampered to some degree?
Absolutely.
By the use of drugs. It's not like somebody who's always been clean and sober their whole life. It's not the same as their ability to make a look better.
Yeah. People have very different capacities around choice. They have very different capacities around choice. And once people start down the path of using mood-altering substances, their capacity to make better choices becomes really limited. Really limited. You know, the odds of making a good choice while you're still sitting at home safe in your chair, pretty straightforward. The odds of making a good choice in the middle of a run, much, much more difficult. But I guess the thing I really want to underscore is that it is and it always is a choice. And that the responsibility for that choice lives only with the person making the choice. There's not a damn thing I can do to keep you sober or make you use. There are things that I can do to make your choice easier or more difficult. But ultimately, if you're rock solid in your recovery, there's not a damn thing I can do short of throwing you to the ground and injecting it in your butt that could get you loaded. It's important to understand that. It's important to understand that, and I'm going to come back to why. To rebuild connection, you need to understand, if you don't struggle from addiction, you need to understand the world of people in addiction. You need to understand something about the emotional exhaustion that comes with loving someone in addiction. You need to understand the processes that need to be in place to get oneself back. You need to understand the sense of healthy emotional detachment. The capacity to disconnect from the roller coaster ride that is somebody in addiction. And for guys struggling with addiction, to reconnect really comes from developing a recovery program and becoming emotionally available. It's really important to recognize, though, that people really need to come together. It's a graph that I do in another workshop, but it bears repeating again that quite often when guys come into MRTC, they come in not doing very well, and at the end of 35 days, if all goes well, they're walking out the front door with life having improved tremendously. The vast majority of people who care about you, though, have been home taking care of business, and they're probably not in the same place you are. They were probably struggling with you when you came in, and they're still struggling now that you're walking out. And if you don't do something to address that gap, one of the things that seems to be a very common phenomena is people end up kind of going to the same level as people in their lives. In other words, if you're living with somebody who's really depressed, it's really easy to find your life becomes depressing. If you're living with somebody who's really conflicted, it's really easy to find your life full of conflict. If you're living with somebody who's doing really well, sometimes you can come up and join them. But the other possibility is they can come down and join you. I guess the thing that I want to underscore, guys, is when you leave treatment, appreciate that many of the people who care about you, and this is the point I'm trying to make, many of the people who care about you are doing the best they can to keep going, but they're struggling. The experience of many of the people I talk to who love our clients is that by the time our guys get into treatment, the people who care about them are running on empty. They're out of gas. The tank it's got vapors in it. It's not that people don't want to support you, it's that most of the people I interview tell me that they don't have another round in them. They don't have another relapse in them. Kind of like our guys walk through our front door because they've been out there using and they're going, I don't think I got another relapse in me. I need treatment. Well, the people that care about you are probably in about the same boat. I don't think I got another round left in me. I'm empty. I'm out of gas. I'm scared. I'm scared because I don't think I could do this one again. I can't handle another round. And it's important to understand that and honor it and respect it and to talk with the people in your lives about how you're going to address that. If you want support from the people who love you, how are you going to support them to make them strong enough to support you? That's the question. Now, all of this is just groundwork for the more important piece that people came here for. Probably the single most important thing people talk to me about when I do family and couples counseling, which is the rebuilding of trust. Number one issue, guys, report to me. The number one thing I want to get my family's trust back. I want to get my wife's trust back. I want to rebuild trust. How do I rebuild trust? Anybody in this room interested in rebuilding trust? I thought so. Seems like pretty much everybody I work with wants it. So what is it? What's trust? Everybody wants it, but nobody knows what it is. What is trust? Trust is something to be earned, but what is it that you earn? Like, so is money. Respect is a component of trust, certainly. A belief that somebody else, yeah. That's a pretty good one. That kind of walk on the walk piece. Let me tell you a couple of stories about trust. How many people in this room, when you woke up this morning, you swung your legs over the side of the bed, how many checked to make sure the floor was there before you stood up? Just one. Okay. Your new medications are coming. So even the guys who are staying on the third floor of this building, I mean, that's a long way up. You didn't check to make sure the floor was there before you just launched out of bed? You trusted it was there. Interesting. I have a friend who trusted the floor one morning. She was out. She and her brother were out somewhere, and it got kind of late, and the place they were at said, why don't you guys just crash here? We'll have the kids camp out in the living room, and you can take their room. And so they said, yeah, seems reasonable. She crawled into bed that night, had the alarm set on her cell phone. Alarm went off the next morning. She hit snooze. The alarm went again. She looked at it. She went, oh, my God, I got to get to work. Swung her legs over the side of the bed and stood up from the top bunk of a bunk bed. Failed to check to make sure the floor was there. Found herself at like 7 o'clock in the morning in free fall. Didn't check to make sure the floor was there. And it let her down. What do you suppose she did the next morning when she woke up? Well, she woke up in her own bed, but what do you suppose she did? Looked first, swung her legs over the side of the bed and checked to make sure there was a floor there before she stood up. And how many days do you suppose she did that for?
Quite a few.
A couple. A couple's reasonable. So another story. People who drove into the center this morning, or when you guys came into treatment, I'm assuming you drove in. How many people followed the instruction in the owner's manual of your vehicle? This is always do a mechanical inspection before operating the vehicle. Walk around and do a visual inspection. How many people did that before getting in your car today? Not even the guy who needs meds. This morning I woke up. I didn't check the car. I just hopped in it, turned the key, and drove to work. 90 kilometers an hour down low heat highway. I'm assuming that all the lug nuts are on the wheels. Maybe a dangerous assumption in my line of business. I don't know. But I didn't check to make sure the lug nuts were there. I just assumed they're there. I mean, I take my car in. Mr. Honda every 4 months says it's fine, safe to drive. I drive it for 4 months. I take it back to Mr. Honda. He keeps telling me the same thing. I keep doing the same thing. We got an arrangement. Same friend. Gets in her car. Turns the key. Drives away. Starts driving down the hill by her place. Watches one of her front wheels roll past her. Dad had been doing a brake job. Got to the last step of the brake job, and the phone rang. He ran inside to take the phone call, and as he was on the phone, she said, "Dad, is the car ready?" And he went, "Yeah," because he done. And so she hopped in the car, and lug nuts weren't properly tightened, and I guess there was only one or two on. They spun off, and away went her wheel. And she fortunately managed to stop her car safely and go retrieve the tire from a kilometer down the road, and they got it all put back together, and her dad's never done another brake job. And what do you suppose happened the next morning when she came out to her vehicle? She walked around and inspected it. You're damn right. And how long do you figure she did that for? A week. Not all that long. That's trust. Right there, everything you need to know about trust. Trust, quite simply, is just being there for another. Over and over and over and over and over. Does it make sense to check to make sure the floor is there when you get out of bed? Well, no. I've been getting out of bed, I don't know how many times, 12, 13, 14,000 times in my life. Every time the floor has been there. Even a guy like me who asks more of floors than most, it's been there for me every time. When I wake up in the morning, it simply wouldn't make sense to check to make sure after, 13,000 consecutive times the floor has done exactly what it said it was going to do. Wouldn't make a lot of sense for me to wake up in the morning and go, "Hey, floor, are you there? You got me covered, buddy?" Would not make a lot of sense. But I got to tell you, if ever the floor wasn't there, if some days the floor was there, some days the floor was gone, odds are pretty good I'd be waking up in the morning and making sure. My vehicle, thousands and thousands of trips, has done exactly what I've asked of it. If some days it did what I asked of it, other days the brakes didn't work, other days the wheels fell off, other days the steering just didn't operate, I probably would have quite a different relationship to my car. You can start to see in the face of that definition why trust is such an issue when guys are struggling with addiction. Being there over and over and over, except this time, but it's not really my fault. But I'm there over and over and over, except for that day, but, buddy came by, I told him not to, and he came by anyway, and what could I do? But I'm there over and over and over and over, except that it was payday, and you weren't here, and I'd had a really bad day. But I'm there over and oh, except for that time, too. The thing about addiction is we know from the research that when people commit to making changes, It's not like people wake up one day and they see some information and all of a sudden they transform their lives. It's like, oh, the Surgeon General says cigarettes are bad for me? Huh. I guess I'm done. It doesn't quite work that way. It's not like getting a bit of information all of a sudden causes everything to be different. What ends up happening, we know, for instance, with tobacco, is that most people make between, somewhere I think on average, is 7 sustained attempts to cease a relationship with tobacco before they see any real long-term tobacco cessation success. Because you kind of start in, and then you're out, and then you're in for a little while longer, and you're out. And even when guys are doing the best they can, even when guys are sincere, sometimes periods of recovery are short. I've watched guys enter and exit recovery within a matter of seconds. How long was your last period of recovery? Oh, I don't know. I watched that guy over there. His last period of recovery lasted about 2.5 seconds. I kid you not. I've seen a guy put down a beer and say, "That's it. No more. I'm done." And then the weight of that word, "I'm done." And you can see the anxiety start to build on him. As he's starting to face, what's life going to be like without it? That's it, I'm done. Starting tomorrow. The interesting thing is the period of time between "I'm done" and starting tomorrow. It's not like Buddy wasn't sincere. It's not like he wasn't honest. It's not like he didn't want that. It's just stuff got in the way. One of the issues with trust in addiction is you know, people are expecting you to walk the walk, to do things consistently, and even when you sincerely want to, as I'm fond of saying around here, you don't know what you don't know until you know you don't know. You know? You don't know that you don't know how to handle this until one day you bump into it. And it's like, well, I guess I didn't know how to handle that. But this time, honey, I promise. But I guess I didn't know how to handle that. But this time, each round you learn a little more. But each round takes a toll. It makes it that much harder to stay connected. That much harder to trust. There are barriers to trust. People get caught up with this preoccupation of meeting the needs of their addiction. An inability to be physically or emotionally present in relationships. A preoccupation with the substance of abuse that really causes people to not be there, to be somewhere else, even when they're not using. Some of my favorite stories around trust, my favorite work around trust, I can think of a couple I worked with about 4 years ago, I guess. A guy came into MRTC and he just did an amazing program. And his wife was just working with him. She was there every step of the way. They were rebuilding their relationship. They were really putting it back together. Beautiful people. And I guess they were about the third, fourth week in treatment. And she came and they attended the workshop, spent the afternoon together. They went out for dinner together and they spent a beautiful evening. And then they came back on the Sunday. We had a session booked. And we were going to talk about how things went on the Sunday. And related this little story. So there they were in the restaurant. And they're having this wonderful time. And they're having this wonderful conversation. And she's talking to him, and he's talking to her, and they're connected, and everything's good. And all of a sudden, it's like he just sort of starts to float away from the table. And she's continuing to talk, and his responses go from being less from being engaged in the conversation and more into, kind of conversation. And she says, "Are you listening to me?" And he says, Oh, yeah, I'm listening. You're talking about Sally and that thing." And she's thinking to herself, "Well, that was about 5 minutes ago. Like, I've moved on from that. Like, where are you?" And he's sitting there and he's becoming more and more distracted. He's kind of fidgeting more and more. And she starts to press him on, "Aren't you listening to me? Like, what's going on? What's wrong with you? What's the matter? Why aren't you paying attention?" And he gets more and more fidgety. And then he just finally says, "Excuse me, I got to go. I got to go to the bathroom." And he gets up and he books it to the bathroom. Just disappears. Mid-sentence, just gotta go, gone. And about 10 minutes later, he comes back to the table, smile on his face, calm, relaxed, sits down across from her, and says, "So yeah, I mean, Sally, that thing with her boss, I really think she should..." And he picks up the conversation right where he was 15 minutes earlier. And he's thinking all's good, and she's sitting there trying to remember the phone number for her divorce lawyer. Why? What just happened? Went and got loaded. Went and used. Obviously. Well, now let me tell you what really happened. Here's a guy with about 4 or 5 months sobriety. Alcohol was a substance of abuse. He's sitting at the table having dinner with his wife. And he hears, right there, the sound of a cork leaving a wine bottle. And I mean, it's not the first time they've been out for dinner. It's not the first time he'd bumped into alcohol. It's not the first time he's seen it. But just for some reason, just the sound of the cork just out of his sight made him snap his head back. And he saw the waiter pouring some wine into a glass, and he could describe the wine hitting the bottom of the glass poetically. It's not, "And then I saw him pour wine into this guy's glass." It was like, "And then the wine hit the bottom of the glass and came up the side and fell back down, and it was this really deep, intense red, and you could see the light refracting through the legs on the side of the glass. And then I watched the guy at the table take a sip, and he said, 'Yeah, that's fabulous, thank you.' So he tasted the wine, and the waiter filled the wine glasses at the table. This guy's head just went. It had been about two and a half months since his last craving. And his head just went. In that moment, it was all he could do to not grab the waiter, throw him to the ground, take the bottle, and just tip it back. He was just gone. And he sat at the table trying to manage this craving. And his wife's talking to him, and he's having this wonderful evening, and he's working on managing this craving. And now she's cueing into the fact that something's wrong, and she's starting to press him on it. "What's wrong? How are you doing?" And, of course, you know, having been in treatment and having learned to really open up and learn the importance of communication and sharing and discussing feelings, he says, "Fine." And she tries to believe that and continue the conversation, but he's just not there. He's just not there. And now he's getting anxious. He's really starting to freak out because now not only is he craving, but she's starting to get choked at him. And she's starting to spot that something's not going right. And he doesn't want to tell her because he doesn't want to worry her. This walking on eggshells thing. It's not just that people walk on eggshells around our guys. Our guys walk on eggshells around the people they care about too. "I don't want to worry her. I don't want her to notice all the things she's noticing." And so he gets to the point where he can't manage her and can't manage his experience of craving and can't manage everything that's going on. And so instead of worrying her, he just says, "Excuse me," and runs to the bathroom like a madman. Damn near takes out a busboy on the way. And he gets to the bathroom. And he says, "Okay, what do I got to do? I got to breathe. Just breathe." And he starts to remember the things that he learned here at the treatment center. He starts to remember some of the workshops. He starts to remember some of the exercises. He remembers that cravings on average last around 7 to 10 minutes. He remembers the importance of breathing. He remembers the relationship of that sort of inner anxiety and to still and quiet the mind. And he just breathes. And he splashes water on his face and he just breathes. And after about 7 minutes, he's feeling fine. He's feeling perfect. He's on top of the world again. And he's feeling proud of himself. He's happy. What a success. This guy just got hit with the biggest craving he's had in, like, his recovery. And he sailed through it perfectly. So he goes back to the table. He sits down and nothing's wrong. In the meanwhile, she's getting ready to divorce him. Because he didn't want to worry her. Because he didn't want to worry her. Didn't want to let her know that I'm weak. If I let her know that I'm weak, if I let her know that I'm craving. In the meantime, she's sitting there looking at this guy going, He's about to get loaded. He's about to get loaded. He's running to the bathroom, and now he's happy. Yeah, I'm not worried. I'm not worried. I'm going to kill him, but I'm not worried. Trust becomes limited when people aren't present in the relationship. Trust becomes limited when people are consumed. Being there over and over and over and over again. Often guys think that that means being with you physically. But it's beyond that. It's being there emotionally, being there intellectually. It's not where are you? I can see that you're here, but where are you? That people need to know. In terms of rebuilding trust, same couple I worked with. About 2 weeks after that day, trust had been quite an issue in their relationship. And I asked her how things were going with trust. And she said that things were a lot better. And so I asked her how much better, and she said, like, a lot better, quantified it for me. And things were just, like, off the charts. There was this transformational change in trust. It was from, we have almost no trust in our relationship one day, to, we have this tremendous amount of trust in our relationship today. And any time people make those big gains, as a counselor, I get real curious about what accounts for that. What can cause such big transformations? Because if it can work in her life, maybe it's something that can work in somebody else's life. So as we're getting ready to do the session, he's in the bathroom and chatting with her about trust, and she says, oh God, a million times better. Well, how do you account for that? What's causing the shift in trust? And I've read a lot. I've looked at a lot of research. I've worked with a lot of couples. I thought I had a pretty good handle on trust and what might be contributing to this big increase in trust. But I asked her, you know, anyway, what accounts for the change in trust? And she looked at me and she said, he had salad. I thought back to all the research I've read on trust, and I can't think of a single instance where I've read a paper on the relationship between salad and trust. Just later and said, I don't get it. Help me understand. Salad? She said, yeah, he had salad. And she explained. So about 5 years earlier, these two people met. And they found that they connected very quickly, and it wasn't too long before they were hand in hand dreaming about where they could go in this world together. Building this vision of a life, they came to realize that when they were hand in hand, life contained possibilities that it didn't have when they were alone. They had these hopes and dreams and aspirations and visions of where they'd end up together. And they made the decision to move through life in a partnership to wherever it would take them. And as they started to walk down that path together, things were good in the beginning. They were beautiful. They were amazing. And these two people committed to walk together forever. But not too long after that, there was this nagging kind of thing about, he seemed to drink a little much sometimes. And she talked to him about, you know, I kind of wonder if maybe you shouldn't take it a little easier. And he said, you know, you're probably right. I probably should take it easier. I should cut down. And then things continued to progress, and she said, you know, I think you may have a problem. And he said, you know, I think you're right. I really should do something about that. And then things started to get really rocky, and it became very evident that he was an alcoholic, and she said, you need to stop. He said, you're absolutely right. I really should get some help. And things continued to progress, and it got rough, and as she was losing hope, as she was losing faith, he came home one day, and he said, you know, I made an appointment to go get some help. And she was relieved. Just when she was losing hope, just when she was losing faith, just when she was losing the belief that they could actually walk through the world together, he said, I'm going to get some help. But she also came to understand that in the process of making that decision, he had come pretty far to the wall with her. She was losing hope on the vision. And his back was to the wall with work. And his back was to the wall in a number of places. And part of her kept having this nagging thought of, is he getting some help because he really wants to make a change, because he's really committed to doing things differently? Or is he getting some help because his back's to the wall? And part of her just couldn't buy into this idea that he was making these changes for his own reasons. And she thought about it, and she reflected on all the ways in which this guy continued throughout their relationship to talk about things that he should do. I really should go back to school. I really should finish my degree. I really should take better care of myself. I really should lose weight. I really should cut down on my alcohol. She realized that for as long as she'd known this guy, he had all sorts of things on this wish list, on this list of things that he should do. But she continued to watch as he didn't do a damn thing. You know, he bought a gym membership because he really should get into shape. He went twice. He really should cut down on this, and it lasted a day. He really should quit drinking. He went a week. And then he came into treatment, and she's starting to believe things are different. She goes out for dinner with him, and he sits down across from her, and something really amazing happens. He orders salad. For all those years, she heard him talk about how he should take better care of himself. He's now actually doing something that will actually contribute to him living longer. Rather than French fries, smothered in gravy, he orders a salad. And then the next thing that was really surprising happens. He ate the salad and appeared to enjoy it. And she went, okay. But she wasn't quite ready to believe him yet. Just because he ate a salad and enjoyed it, she said, okay, I've got to wait for it. But then he did the most amazing thing of all. He failed to ask her for a gold star because he ate his salad. He failed to say to her, honey, look how good I'm doing. I ate salad. Aren't you proud? And she started to think about it, and she started to think, if he's going to eat salad like it's no big deal, if he's going to eat salad like it's something that he likes to do, and if he's going to start taking better care of himself, not because of me, not because of anyone else, but just because he thinks it's the right thing to do. After all these years of hearing him talk about the things he should do, this time, I'm seeing him actually do something about it. I'm seeing him walk the walk and not ask for praise, not ask for validation. He's simply walking the walk. And maybe, just maybe, if he's willing to look after himself like he said he should for all these years, then maybe, just maybe, he's willing to commit to a life of abstinence like he said he should for all these years. And then maybe, just maybe, we can walk the path that once upon a time we had agreed to walk on together. Trust. Trust is not built in the big things. Trust is built in all the small ways. Trust is built in integrity. Doing what you say you'll do when you say you'll do it. Not because you're going to get a gold star for doing it. Not because you're going to get punished for not doing it. But simply because you've decided that's the right thing to do. Just because you've decided that's who I am and that's what I stand for. Trust. One of the final pieces I like to cover is one of the classic mistakes that I see people make when they look at the whole issue of trust. Far too many of the people I work with see the question of trust kind of like this. It's like, do I trust? Yes, no. Trust is a yes-no equation. Do I trust them completely? No. Therefore, I must not trust them. Well, it doesn't quite work like that. Trust really isn't a yes-no exercise. Let me explain. can you lend me a dollar? Can you lend me a dollar? Great. Obviously, somebody trusts me. Given that you trust me, can you lend me $10,000? I thought you trusted me. What's going on? I thought you trusted me a minute ago. Now you don't trust me? What's going on? I'm confused. But you trust me, right? If you didn't trust me, you wouldn't lend me a dollar. Now that I asked for $10,000, all of a sudden you don't trust me? It's too much? Huh. Trust is not a yes-no question. Trust operates on a continuum, on a scale. On a scale of perfect mistrust to perfect trust. And there's two things that impact our capacity to trust. One is, how much do I trust somebody on that scale of 0 to 10? And the other thing is, what does it cost me if I'm wrong? Part of it is the risk, and part of it is the amount of trust. And one of the mistakes people make is thinking that if I don't have complete 10 out of 10 trust for somebody, I must not trust them at all. It's like, well, I guess I don't trust my partner because, you know, I wouldn't let him, you know, walk around in early recovery with $10,000 cash in his pocket. Maybe that's a lack of trust, or maybe that's just good common sense. Being willing to lend me a dollar? Why not? What's the downside if I let you down? $10,000? Yeah, unless you're Bill Gates, probably too much. What's the consequence if I let you down? See, the thing about trust is all of us are capable of letting somebody down, even through no fault of our own. I could borrow the $10,000 with every intention of paying it back. I could be the most trustworthy guy on the planet. And then I discover, I don't know, I get hit by a bus. There's nothing in writing. Total amnesia. You don't end up getting your money back. Nobody's fault, it just works out that way. If you start to look at this continuum of trust, you start to discover that people live in different places on this continuum. Odds are pretty good, well, for me anyway. Some of my acquaintances, I can have people in my life that I trust maybe 4 to 6 out of 10. I don't trust them much, but they're not that close in. I hang out with them, I enjoy their company, but I wouldn't leave my kid with them, and I wouldn't give them my car. Most of my friends, I trust at least 8 out of 10. Do I trust my friends completely? Most of them probably not, for all kinds of reasons. I have people who are very close to me that I know are just somewhat unreliable. There are people in my life close to me that I know if I lent some money to, they might not even remember. You know, remember that $50 I lent you? What $50? It's like, oh, again. Does that eliminate them from my life from being a friend? Probably not. For me to have a relationship, how much do I need to trust somebody? Well, I trust my wife 9.995 out of 10. The other 0.005, that's just left over for the it happens factor. The reality is, you can never really know. You can never really know, and sometimes people let you down through no fault of their own. I trust my wife as completely as anyone could trust anyone. And I believe that right now she's at home looking after our kids. I have no reason to believe anything other than the fact. Is it possible that right now she's at home loaded? I guess anything's possible. I have no reason to believe that. But I've worked with a whole lot of people who had no reason to believe the stuff that they bumped into as well. Do I need 100% ironclad guarantee that everything will work out in life before I can have a relationship or a marriage? No. I just need to get far enough along that, kind of like the floor, I'm far enough along that, you know what, I'll just assume it's there. The more it costs me, the more I'm risking, the higher that number has to be. Would I trust the Dalai Lama with $10,000? Probably. Trust is not a yes-no question. Trust really operates on a continuum. And many of the guys I work with, as they're trying to rebuild trust, they kind of feel like this, what, don't you trust me yet? Don't you trust me yet? You don't trust me. You know, you're not giving me this complete and total trust. And therefore, you don't trust me, and therefore, you know, life is hard or whatever. And my thought is, if somebody's maintaining any kind of emotional connection to you, there is some level of trust. They're risking something. Are they risking as much as you want? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. I mean, we all know at some point you need to make that leap of faith. At some point, that here and gone and here and gone and here and gone and in and out thing from the addiction, you have to let go of at some point. Can you do that when Buddy's got a week clean? Probably not. It might be a little bit early. When Buddy's got 36 hours sober, might be a little early to go, you know what, I trust you completely in this life of recovery. When he's got 25 years sober, it's probably time. You know? I don't think that I can live with you having a bank card being 1 week out of treatment. But to say to somebody, you know what, I know you're 25 years out of treatment, but I'm just not ready. Maybe when you take your 30-year cake, I'll be ready for you to walk around with a bank card. So waiting 25 years is probably too long. A week is probably too early. Where do you draw the line? Well, unfortunately, the only answer I have is somewhere between a week and 25 years. And you're going to have to find that line yourself. How do you know when it's time? I don't know. You just... ultimately, what it represents is a leap of faith. Ultimately, you look down and it looks like the floor's there. And you stand up and you hope you're right. Ultimately, you just one day make a leap and you lean on someone and you take a risk. And it either pans out or it doesn't. To bring it back to the stuff I was talking about early, though, the stuff about reconnecting and recovery, the stuff about people in your life struggling. Appreciate that when people in your life are operating on vapors, when people who care about you don't have a lot left, when people who care about you emotionally just don't think they could do another round, it's going to be really, really hard for them to trust. It's going to be really, really hard for them to open up. It's going to be really hard for them to put their heart on the line yet again. However, 6 months down the road, a year down the road, sometime down the road, if you've spent some time helping build them up, if they've spent some time looking after themselves, if you guys have spent some time healing together and recovering together, odds are pretty good you'll have enough in the bank to take a risk and to start the trust. One thing that guys often ask me is, how long does it take to rebuild trust? Well, there's kind of a good news, bad news answer. The bad news is, it never happens as quickly as you'd like. The good news is, it always happens faster than you'd expect. How do you encourage that process along? Well, again, work your recovery program without waiting for outside validation. Do the right thing. Because it's the right thing to do. Be a trustworthy person, engaging in acts of honesty. Take an active interest in your loved ones' lives. Be there, emotionally, physically. Become a person of integrity. Do what you say you'll do, when you say you'll do it. Guys often show up on this stage with a gratitude certificate saying, I got 35 days clean, don't you trust me now? You know, the interesting thing is most of the people who love our clients have a hard time trusting in the face of that certificate. Yeah, so what? The big things? So what? I clean a month now. Don't you trust me? I got a gratitude certificate. Don't you trust me? Those aren't the things that win the trust. What wins the trust are the small things. You take out the garbage on Tuesday night because it's Tuesday. And you said you'd take the garbage out. Without prompting. And without looking for a reward. You said you'd be home at 6 and you're home at 5:58. And the next night you said you'd be home at 6, and you phone at 5 to 6, saying, I just want to let you know traffic's bad. I'm going to be about 10 minutes late. I'm right here right now, but I'll be there. Hang tight. And then you show up not 10 minutes later, but 5 minutes later. Traffic wasn't as bad as I thought. Doing the small things. Being a person of integrity. Being there for another. Over and over and over and over again. Helping the people in your lives build up enough strength to take a risk. Best way to get you to lend me $10,000? Give you $3 million. If I gave you $3 million, would you lend me $10,000? Maybe. And then there's some people who just aren't open for business. And that's okay too. So connecting and recovery. Understand that the walking on eggshells thing just creates separation. Engaging in acts of honesty. Honesty not just about where you've been, but honesty about how you've been. Sharing the struggles. Being okay letting someone in your life know where you're at. And being okay hearing where they're at. Moving together, recovering together, healing together. Ordering salad. Doing the right things because it's the right thing to do. Do that, and I really like your chances. Next week I'm going to be talking about the road to relapse, the path to guys in the face of making a commitment to abstain, finding themselves in situations where they're on the road to using. So responding to the fears of relapse is next week. That's enough for this week. Thanks for your attention.